Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you. Keeping warm in Latvia, it's limiting imports of Russian fuels. That's meant all fuels are pricier, even wood pellets and firewood.
It's three times more than last year.
So Latvians are adding layers of clothing, lowering thermostats, and generally preparing for a tough winter. I'm Marco Werman. Also today on the show, Israel and Lebanon sign an historic maritime border agreement.
So it's definitely a major achievement and a major win for the Biden administration in the Middle East. And more importantly, as I said, it removes a source of tension between the two countries.
And in Belarus, troops are deploying to Ukraine's border. Dissidents say this is a fight the Belarusians don't want, but they're afraid of their own government.
I'd never imagined my people so silent, so cautious.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to have you here. Across much of the Northern Hemisphere, autumn is settling in. In Europe, that means governments are scrambling to find ways to keep people warm this winter without depending on Russian energy. In the tiny northern Baltic states, the urgency is even greater. In Riga, the capital of Latvia, nighttime temperatures tomorrow are forecast to be just a few degrees above freezing. We start off today with reporter Jerry Haddon in Riga on how people there are bracing for the months ahead.
On a chilly October morning outside Riga's main hospital, an elderly woman wrapped in a shawl is trying to sell wool socks to people heading inside. Have a look, she tells me. Dig around in the pile for the warmer ones. Extra wool clothing for the cold, indoors. It actually makes sense here in Latvia right now, because the government has capped heat in health facilities at about 65 degrees. A school teacher named Anastasia Bushkeva is heading in. She doesn't stop for socks, but winter is on her mind.
I was in hospital in summer. It was okay, but now in winter, no one knows what will be. Really, people are afraid.
Bushkeva has lymphoma. The hospital is scary enough, she says, without having to worry about staying warm. Winters in Latvia are long and harsh. Temperatures can stay below zero for weeks. To maximize savings, the government's austerity plan also applies to other public spaces, including schools. On Latvia University's Natural Sciences campus, there are two big buildings. This winter, says Professor Juris Peters, they're closing one, keeping it just warm enough so the pipes won't freeze.
Now we accept the lower standard for heating. And that means you should use the warm underwear, like, for example, like me.
Peters opens a button on his dress shirt, tugs on his long johns underneath. But there are bigger problems than having to stay warm, says environmental science undergrad Samantha Dzuragula. Closing half the campus means half the laboratories are now off limits.
I'm really sad and disappointed because we cannot work in laboratories. So we have like two in a week and we cannot do that.
But Dragula says she's taking it in stride, especially when she thinks of all the suffering among Ukrainians as they defend themselves against Russia. Russia, Latvia's giant next-door neighbor. It supplies this tiny nation with most of its electricity and natural gas. Like the rest of Europe, Latvia is trying to change that by importing liquefied natural gas through Estonia and ramping up renewables. But the transition will take time. For Latvians, who number about 2 million, this winter's likely to be tough. Ask people who live in Riga's so-called Khrushchev ghettos. They're the Soviet-era housing blocks you see everywhere, drab, dilapidated, and poorly insulated. On a recent evening, resident Evita Rosenfelde says she's worried about her next few utility bills and keeping her kids comfortable. I haven't turned on the heat yet, she says, but when I do, the government won't let me turn up the thermostat above 65 degrees. At another Khrushchev-era building, office worker Marika Shutile says she and her husband are steeling themselves for the worst. As for our teenage boys, she jokes, they both play hockey. They're used to the ice, she says. So for them, the apartment won't be so cold. Jokes aside, Schutele worries the factory where her husband works might close due to high heating costs. The big question, she says, is what the government will do to help. So far, authorities have announced some limited subsidies. It also says it has enough natural gas reserves to get everyone through the winter, if people are careful. With fuel prices already so high, lots of people are falling back on firewood. Latvia is mostly forest, and more than half of homes heat with wood, or byproducts like these compressed blocks made from sawdust. Problem is, wood prices are skyrocketing too.
One bag, €6. I'm not sure how anyone could afford it.
That's Imants Lipinč, my interpreter here, showing me around a store that sells all kinds of wood products for heating. Keeping his house warm till May with sawdust blocks would run him about €3,600. That's roughly $3,500, more than three times what he would normally pay over the winter. Wood pellets, another popular fuel, have also shot up in price. At a Riga hardware store, a bag of pellets sells for about $9. Office worker Artis Strautinč is buying some, reluctantly.
So it's three times more than last year.
Can you afford it?
Well, if you need heat, you have to buy it, so there's no choice.
No choice but to pay more and heat less. It's going to be a cold winter in Latvia, outside and inside. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Riga, Latvia.
Energy isn't the only security concern Latvia is grappling with. The country shares a 134-mile-long border, not to mention a long, acrimonious history, with Russia. Later this week, Jerry reports from that border where a state of emergency has been declared while people are desperate to cross over. The war in Ukraine appears to be widening. In recent days, trainloads of Russian troops have been entering Belarus, which sits just to the north of Ukraine. And together, Russian and Belarusian troops are deploying near Ukraine's border. The president of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, says it's purely a defensive measure, but concerns are rising that Belarusian troops might enter Ukraine. Among those watching developments closely is Franek Viachorka. He's a Belarusian politician and the chief political advisor to Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, the exiled leader of the democratic opposition in Belarus. He joins us from Brussels. Franek, these trainloads of Russian troops arriving in Belarus, why are they there?
Because Putin needs Belarus as the territory to launch missiles on Ukraine. For Putin, Lukashenko is the only ally in this war. And for Putin, it's very important to make sure that the society is under his control, that no one resists, and Belarusian infrastructure is fully available to him. And the Russian troops is the best guarantee that no one will protest. Unfortunately, it means that my country is under occupation right now.
So those Belarusian troops, it won't just be an excuse to launch missiles, right? Will they also be deployed into Ukraine? And if that happens, what could that lead to?
Russian troops that are coming to Belarus, they will be definitely used against Ukraine, probably to launch missiles or to launch warplanes which launch in missiles. But Belarusian troops will not fight against Ukraine. Belarusians, they don't have this chauvinism or imperialism. They don't understand this war. They don't understand why they should die for Putin or for Lukashenko. They believe that Ukrainians are the closest nation to Belarusians. So I don't believe Belarusians will enter this war. I even feel that Russians don't trust Belarusians. You know, Belarusians in general, they are much closer to Ukrainians than to Russians. But Russians will do all possible to quarrel our nation. And we feel it already how propaganda is trying to create this feeling that Ukrainians are not brothers anymore, they're enemies. And this worry me a lot.
In his mobilization of troops, Putin doesn't see an opportunity to get more troops like those Belarusian troops on his side?
Putin is desperate right now. He's recruiting just ordinary guys with no experience. So he is like Stalin in the Second World War. He's trying to win not by quality, but by quantity. And many of these young Russian men could be sent to Belarus in order to create pressure on Ukraine from the northern border, in order to distract Ukrainian armed forces, and also in order to keep Belarusian population in fear. Belarusians are scared so much right now that I couldn't imagine street protests. When people see Russian soldiers on the streets, they do really scare. I'd never imagine my people so silent, so cautious, I have family members and friends in Belarus, and they say that they're living like in a Nazi Germany or Stalin's USSR.
And where does that silence, where does that fear come from?
The news are every day about someone arrested. State propaganda, they are showing on YouTube the videos of interrogations in KGB. So before you watch your favorite cartoon on YouTube, you have to watch how people in KGB prison are being interrogated. So there is a feeling of impunity, the feeling of violence. People are afraid of losing jobs or losing lives. And this creates this total feeling of fear. Before, like 2-3 years ago, I was in jail 4 times, for example. I was also in prison, was also beaten, also tortured. But what happened to me years before, it's not comparable to what's happening to people right now. Those who managed to quit Belarusian prison, they're very thin. You know, there is no more human look in them.
So, Franak, what is your main concern with these Russian troop movements to Belarus?
My main concern is that they will stay forever. My main concern is that Belarus will lose its sovereignty. Putin is the guy who doesn't see Belarus or Ukraine as separate countries at all. He even said that Belarusians and Ukrainians are not the nations. He believed that we are like Russians, but a bit different from Russians. And he will be very happy to destroy our national identity and everything which differs us from Russians. And the Russian troops, this is like a guarantee that Belarus will be under Russian control. Therefore, we go to Brussels. Therefore, we go to Washington, to London with Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. And we ask every day at every meeting that the world help us to save the country. We understand that Ukraine is in focus right now, but Belarus is under attack today at this moment as well.
So Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko says strikes on the territory of Belarus are not just being discussed in Ukraine today, but are also being planned. Is there any truth to that?
You know, it sounds like casus belli for me. It sounds that they're looking for a pretext to escalate. If you summon the Ukrainian ambassador, like it happened last week, and saying that you Ukrainians are going to attack us, this sounds exactly like an attempt to drag Belarus into the war. They're looking for the pretext. They try to make Ukraine guilty in escalation. But Ukraine does not impose any threat. Ukraine is defending its territory. Ukraine doesn't need to attack Belarus at all, but they are trying to provoke.
We should point out there are Belarusians fighting on Ukraine's side in this war. One of their leaders was killed in action in late June near Lysychansk. How many have joined the fight? And are you and your colleagues on the side of Tikhanovskaya's team in touch with the people who have taken up arms inside Ukraine?
We are really proud of many Belarusians who joined Ukrainian armed forces. They have created at least 4 battalions. They are fighting on the front line. At least 15 people were killed by Russians during this fight. Now they participate in the counteroffensive of Ukrainian army. And, you know, they use Belarusian symbols. They use Belarusian language between themselves. This is the biggest foreign unit within Ukrainian army. And I think they are really defending Belarusian honor. They really show that Belarusians are not equal to the regime, that Belarusians stand with Ukraine. I don't know what role they will play in liberation of Belarus. I don't know what role they will play in the future, building a democratic free country. But what we know for sure that they are heroes. They are risking their lives to save not even their country, but neighboring country, understanding that with defending Ukraine, they also defend Belarus.
Franak Viacharka is a Belarusian politician. He's also the chief political advisor to Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, the exiled Belarusian leader of the country's democratic opposition. Franak joined us from Brussels. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ahead, possible solutions for the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Lebanon and Israel, two neighbors that technically have been at war since the creation of Israel in 1948. Today, though, they gave diplomacy a chance. It seems they've reached a historic deal establishing a long-disputed maritime border. That is paving the way for exploration of offshore natural gas fields. Joining me now is Rhonda Slim. She's a senior fellow with the Middle East Institute in Washington. The U.S. mediated this deal, Rhonda. What are the details? How did this all shake out?
What we know is that there was an area that was disputed between Israel and Lebanon of about 330 square miles, you know, each country claiming that area as part of their exclusive economic zone. The deal basically gives Lebanon pretty much what it has asked for in terms of where its maritime border will be situated, but also it gives Israel acknowledgement of a line of buoy of about 3 miles that starts from the land border into the Mediterranean Sea, which Israel claims it needs this line for its own security.
So what does this deal actually establish as the maritime border between Israel and Lebanon? I mean, Israel's just to the south of Lebanon. Help us visualize that border, if you can, and how it changes things on the ground or in the sea.
You know, each country has its own exclusive economic zone around its territorial waters. I think the economic conditions in Lebanon, which are very bad, and the prospects of gas deposits that can help Lebanon, in a way, salvage its economic situation, I think changed the mindset in Lebanon about the deal. And in Israel, you have a prime minister, Lapid, who is facing elections in November and is interested in showing that he was able to strike what he called a historic deal.
So, Rhonda, how are Lebanon's politicians reacting to this news? Are they giving ordinary Lebanese any hope this could benefit them? And could those end up being empty promises?
So once they start exploring in the Kana field, you know, where everybody is hoping they'll find a lot, there is a 80% chance they might not find anything, one. But two, it's going to take anywhere from 5 to 7 years for money to start flowing into the Lebanese government coffers. And three, there is a fear because of this corruption, institutionalized corruption in Lebanon, that whatever money is going to come out will not really reach the citizen, but it will reach the pockets of this, you know, corrupt political and business elite. And that's why right now the challenge going forward is to establish a sovereign wealth fund, independently managed and under, you know, accountable to the Lebanese people, where money flowing from these gas resources, which belong to all of the Lebanese, are put into this fund and invested to the benefit of the Lebanese.
So, Rhonda, you pointed out earlier that domestically in Israel, Prime Minister Yair Lapid is facing elections. What do you think this deal means for Israel?
So for Israel, I mean, it helps it secure the security interest of Israel. So there was a real threat that Hezbollah might live up to its promise or threat of going to war if Israel were to explore or to pump gas from this Karish field, which is, you know, being linked to this, was linked to this negotiation. So on one hand, it removes this point of tension and the source of tension and potential war, a source of war between Lebanon and Israel. But it's more importantly, it invests the Lebanese in continuing the state of cold peace across the border.
So, Rhonda, having mediated this deal, how do you think the Biden administration will spin this? A big victory?
I mean, this is a major win for the Biden administration in the Middle East. I mean, as we said earlier, these two countries have been at a state of war since 1948. So it's definitely a major achievement. And more importantly, as I said, it removes a source of tension between the two countries, which, if not dealt with, could have the potential of leading to war, you know, and the last thing that the Biden administration needs right now in the Middle East is another war in the Middle East to focus on, to deal with, given what's going on in Ukraine.
Rhonda Slim is a senior fellow and director of Conflict Resolution and Track 2 Dialogues Program with the Middle East Institute in Washington. Rhonda, thank you so much for explaining this.
Thank you very much.
The Great Pacific Garbage Patch, a massive floating accumulation of plastic debris in the North Pacific. It is twice the size of Texas. It's also been the intense focus of cleanup efforts. That cleanup is now moving to Los Angeles. A Dutch company, the Ocean Cleanup, has signed a deal with LA County to install a floating mechanical filter in Biona Creek, the canal that runs through the city and out into the Pacific Ocean. Chris Reddy is a senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, where he studies marine pollution, and city's been following the progress of microplastic cleanup efforts. Chris, what will this machine in the LA Canal actually do?
That's a really clever idea. It's, you know, basically a floating little conveyor belt. It's picking up plastics right downstream from a river, which has been identified as a major input of plastics to the local area. So it kind of looks a little MacGyver, but it's, you know, looks like it's well designed. And these folks who are doing it, the Ocean Cleanup Group, you know, they've been ahead of the game and they take this seriously. This is not a high school science fair project.
Yeah, so basically filtering out the plastic debris before it even gets to the ocean. When you say it's MacGyvered, what does it look like?
It looks like a floating, you know, kind of a boat, but it doesn't have like the typical lines that we would think of a boat. And, you know, it's this object in the middle of the coastline, but instead of sailing away, it's picking up different pieces of plastic debris and sorting it and eventually sorting it and getting it out of our ocean.
When we are talking about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, and if we get to the source of all that plastic in the North Pacific, the reporting suggests that the sources of some 80% of that debris is about 1,000 rivers around the globe. What is the reality check on that?
You know, I think it's a good place to start. I don't think we have the data yet to actually make those types of arguments. I mean, I think it's reasonable to identify that most of the plastic is coming from land. And, you know, the major input term from the land is rivers. So it's not a stretch.
Right. And the floating mechanical filter in Biona Creek in LA, that is would be tied to that effort, presumably.
And I think this is the right way to do it. The idea of cleaning up plastics in the ocean, you know, garbage patches, as they're coined, sounds very romantic. But Mother Nature is a fickle beast. I wouldn't want to make a living being out in the middle of the blue ocean trying to clean up pieces of plastic. It's too dangerous. It's too costly. And it's a much smarter move to do it closer to land where it's safer. You have a much better logistics and infrastructure to support it, as well as I think the powerful outcomes of, you know, social awareness and how you can engage the local community about what they're polluting and how it's getting captured.
So far, Chris, as a species, we have not been very successful at cleaning up after ourselves, just generally. What's the current thinking on how we can change that behavior?
Well, I mean, there's a couple ways. I mean, certainly giving a sense of awareness about doing a better job. But on the flip side, I see great hope in terms of how we manufacture plastics. You know, in the past, there was a sense of quality control that you had to make a piece of plastic for your shampoo bottle, and it had to last, you know, a year. Somebody decided when they were buying the plastic from the plastic bottle producer, just make sure it can last for a year.
Just make sure the shampoo doesn't leak out of it.
The problem is that the producer might have made it last 1 year, but maybe on the back end, it really could have lasted up to 100 years. Mm. Unlike many other pollution issues in the ocean, I see great hope with plastic pollution, because I think that we have ways to design next generation materials. I see cleanup, and I see a lot of places out there where I don't think plastics are the worst, you know, stressors to the ocean. I think that's more of carbon dioxide and ocean acidification. But solving a plastic problem is much more attainable in the next couple of decades than it is ocean acidification. And that's where I see great hope.
Chris Reddy is a senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution on Cape Cod. He was updating us on progress to rid the oceans of microplastics. Chris, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
You're with the world. On the San Diego-Tijuana border sits Friendship Park, and a fence that separates not just two nations, but also many families.
You know, we've seen people say goodbye to their family members through that fence, yeah, because someone's dying. We've seen family members say hello to a new child or grandchild.
Still ahead, we meet the families at Friendship Park on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It was not too long ago that the rallying cry at Trump rallies came down to three words: build that wall. That would be a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. President Trump devoted significant political capital to getting it done. In a couple of minutes, we'll look at the impact of one small stretch of that border between San Diego and Tijuana. But first, what's going on with the border wall in Texas? Uriel Garcia is a reporter with the Texas Tribune in El Paso.
Under the Trump administration, it built 81 miles of new barrier along the U.S.-Mexico border, 21 of which was in Texas.
Before Trump took office, Texas already had 90 miles of barrier with Mexico. That's in a state whose international border is 1,200 miles long. I asked Garcia, what were Texans initially promised with a border wall?
So what was promised in Texas is that they were going to build a wall along the Texas-Mexico border. What's unique about Texas, unlike some of the other southwestern states like California, New Mexico, or Arizona, is that a lot of the land along the Texas-Mexico border is privately owned, meaning that in order to be able to build a wall or anything, the federal government needs to get into negotiations or take land from private landowners.
So you just wrote about a new 14-mile section of wall that was approved. Where is it located and when was it approved?
Right. So earlier or last year, I should say, the Texas governor had said that because the Biden administration had ended its efforts to build a wall, a federal wall, the state was going to pick up that responsibility. And it's awarded three different contracts so far. And so far, 1.7 miles of new state wall has been built in the Rio Grande Valley. And recently, two more contracts were awarded to build 14 new miles of wall. That would be in the Rio Grande Valley in an area called Del Rio. So the contract calls for 14 miles of new wall, but we don't know exactly when that's going to start and where specifically along those areas the wall is going to be erected.
So these are new contracts. Is Biden continuing to build the wall that Trump famously made his calling card?
To be clear, this is state effort. So this is Governor Abbott erecting these walls. What Biden is doing, however, under the Trump administration, so much money was already approved by Congress to build the wall. In order for those efforts to actually stop, Congress needs to reappropriate the money. That hasn't been done. And efforts in Congress have started on, with Democrats leading the efforts, but Congress has not agreed to repurpose that money. So the Biden administration has to use that money for border walls. So in order to go around that technicality is that they're doing environmental assessments in different parts of the border.
So what is the cost, and is that all paid for by American taxpayers?
Right. So it depends on who analyzes the cost, right? Because there's different contractors giving different prices depending on the market. The material may cost more or less, but let's take, for example, what Texas is doing. Right now, with the first contract that they awarded, it was at $162 million, right? So, and that's of 8 miles of new wall, and that comes out about just over $20 million a mile. And wow. In comparison, what the Trump administration was doing, that ranged from $6 million to $34 million per mile.
I mean, how effective are walls at curbing illegal migration into the U.S.? What have you found in your reporting?
So former Border Patrol agents have told me that it may delay illegal crossings, but it doesn't completely prevent it, particularly now with the type of migrants that we're talking about. We're talking about many of them are asylum seekers, meaning that they're looking to turn themselves into Border Patrol agents to be able to start the asylum process. So a wall doesn't necessarily prevent someone from seeking asylum, but once they turn themselves in, they'll be able to start the asylum process. And the other thing to keep in mind, even before the current trend of asylum seekers coming at the border, is that many of the undocumented immigrants that we have now, just about half of them actually came to the U.S. legally and simply overstayed their visa.
Uriel Garcia is an immigration reporter at the Texas Tribune, speaking with us from El Paso. Uriel, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
That's The View from Texas. Go to the far western end of the U.S.-Mexico border, all the way to the Pacific Ocean, and you'll find a 30-foot-wide concrete plaza called Friendship Park. It straddles Tijuana and San Diego, a few hundred feet from where the steel wall girders disappear into the ocean. On the U.S. side, Friendship Park itself is hemmed in. Metal barricades cut right through it. Now there are plans underway to fortify it even more. The park is a place where families separated by the border could at least see and talk with one another, even if through the barrier. That is, until the pandemic, when the park closed and public access was mostly cut off on the U.S. side. Now community leaders on both sides of the border are worried that the closure of Friendship Park may be permanent once construction of a solid border wall is complete. In the meantime, a group that calls itself the Friends of Friendship Park continues to hold cross-border outdoor church services there. Reporters Manolo Morales and Sarah Wyman of the podcast Atlas Obscura traveled to both sides of the border for this story.
Once I got to Mexico, I knew I was in Mexico right away because I heard the Mexican music that my parents play at home. And there were people selling, tacos, tamales. I walked to a pharmacy's parking lot, and there I met Javier. He's a 67-year-old man who volunteers for the weekly church service and is driving me to Friendship Park.
Manolo.
Sí.
Javier was born in Tijuana, and growing up, he would ride his bike back and forth between this country and California without showing any type of documentation. The fences you see here today didn't exist when he was just a kid. When I get to Friendship Park, I see a lively boardwalk strip. There are families heading to the beach with their chairs, snacks, towels, and some even carrying their pets on wagons.
So at some point around this time, I get a text from Manolo that basically says, Sarah, it is a community here. I am in the middle of a 2-mile hike to the U.S. side of the border. You can't park closer to the border than that on the U.S. side because it's in a state park.
Keep an eye out. Oh, watch out, watch out, watch out, watch out.
That is Seth Clark. He's a pastor for the Border Church. It's a group of non-sectarian Christian ministers and worshipers who gather on either side of the border every Sunday. And on our way over there, Seth saved me from being bitten by a rattlesnake.
And there's one in there.
Exciting stuff.
All right.
45 minutes later, as the two of us approach to the U.S. side of the border,
And now I can crouch in the wind shelter too.
I started to get the sense that we were missing out on something. I could not see the community that Manolo had texted me about, but I could hear it.
Yeah, you can hear the music.
Yeah.
If you get close enough, you can start to smell the food. Yeah, I can smell churros, and I smell roasted barbecue shrimp and tacos, of course.
It does feel a little bit like attending a party you weren't invited to, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Our mommy told you you couldn't go in.
Seth says back when you could enter the garden between the borders, more families would show up for the service on the American side. But since the park closed, Seth often makes the walk to the border church by himself. Every once in a while, someone shows up for the church service who hasn't heard that the park is closed.
This, about 3 weeks ago, a man came down from Seattle to see grandma, and maybe for the last time. And it didn't happen because Friendship Park wasn't open. You know, we've seen people say goodbye to their family members through that fence because someone's dying. We've seen family members say hello to a new child or grandchild. You know, you your first time you ever lay eyes on your own child might be through that fence.
Right.
Today, we're the only ones on this side of the border. It doesn't take Seth long to set up for the service.
Over the course of an hour, maybe about 50 people gathered on the Mexico side for the church service.
Mi nombre es Gabriela.
Including a woman named Gabriela and her 4 children. One rode a scooter, another one was saying hi to everyone. We're not using Gabriela's last name due to concerns about her safety.
Y queremos un día poder recibir asilo político, porque a mí la delincuencia organizada me asesinó a mi esposo y a mis 2 hijos.
6 months ago, her husband and 2 oldest children were murdered.
Entonces tengo que estar siempre fuerte por ellos, pero yo tuve que ver las fotografías de mis hijos, cómo me los dejaron tirados todos balaceados de su pecho. Ay, no fue algo muy terrible.
She's now seeking asylum in the U.S., and while she's waiting to hear back, she comes to this church service.
Porque cada día siento una paz muy, muy grande en este lugar.
Coming here gives her this sense of peace. It's a place where her kids can feel part of a community. This is a place where Gabriela doesn't have to worry or bottle up all her feelings.
Pastor Seth, are you there?
Seth's cell phone rang. It was Guillermo Navarrete calling. He's the pastor on the other side of the border. He organizes the church service in Tijuana.
Sí, estoy aquí. Can you hear me?
The two of them started conducting the service together.
The border and its infernal walls make us cry to God. Save us. We ask that God would make this place like heaven. Cada semana, alabamos a Dios mientras esperamos que el reino.
But there were also these moments where suddenly you'd be jarred out of that reverie and reminded where you were. Like at one point, this helicopter showed up and started circling right above us.
About halfway through the service, Guillermo told us to get up from the chairs we've been sitting on.
And Gabriela will lead us.
We followed Gabriela and her kids past the tent and the TV and the speakers, and we walked towards the fence along the border. Javier was standing next to me. He leaned onto the fence as if he was praying over it.
Hosanna! Hosanna!
Seth and I climbed up on a small concrete wall. I could see silhouettes of people on the other side of the border, but it was hard to make out any faces.
Okay. Here we make our confession. We have not done what is right. As individuals, as families, as societies and nations, and let us raise our hands to the sky.
Around me, all 50 of us raised our arms. We pointed our pinkies towards the sky. People on their way to the beach stopped, and they were watching what we were doing.
I was standing next to Seth. I raised my arm without really thinking about it. I remember looking at my hand and seeing it silhouetted against the blue sky, and faintly through the fence, being able to see that there were people on the Mexican side doing the same thing, kind of reaching towards us.
We see only one sky above us. The border does not stop the sky or the clouds in it.
La frontera no nos limita para poder apreciar tu grandeza.
And let us pass to each other a sign of peace.
Ahora saludémonos con el beso del meñique.
The pinky kiss.
The pinky kiss.
If I were at the wall, I would touch your finger and pass Christ's peace to you.
Me gustaría estar en la frontera, en el muro.
Paz de Cristo.
Paz de Cristo.
Peace of Christ.
Peace of Christ.
On our side of the border, Gabriela's children started a line of people touching their pinkies together, just like a pinky promise. No one remembers who started this tradition, but back when Friendship Park was open, it was the easiest way to reach through the tiny openings in the fence. We didn't know each other. That moment felt like it brought us together.
For the world, I'm Sarah Wyman, Friendship Park, San Diego.
And I'm Manolo Morales, Friendship Park, Tijuana.
Their story comes to us from the podcast Atlas Obscura. In Japan today, the tourists are back. Pandemic border restrictions were finally lifted there after 2 long years. Gone is the daily cap of 50,000 arrivals. Visa-free travel is possible again for visitors to Japan from more than 60 countries. Airlines are adding more flights as well. What does remain in place? Face masks, worn by most Japanese just about everywhere outside of their own homes. It's hard to believe, but the COVID pandemic has been part of our reality for 2.5 years. And for 2.5 years, governments everywhere have been balancing the economics of lifting COVID restrictions against the risk of the disease spreading. Tomorrow on the show, we'll look at how countries are deciding what restrictions to keep and which to toss during a pandemic that still is not over. Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the former head of the Russian oil company Yukos. His business savvy made him at one point the richest man in Russia. Now he lives in exile in London. In a new book, The Russia Conundrum, How the West Fell for Putin's Power Gambit and How to Fix It, Khodorkovsky describes a future where Russia is welcomed back into the global community. He spoke with me last week through an interpreter. Today, part two of our interview, we pick up on the question of who in Russia is able to confront Putin. What is the state of opposition and dissent across Russia? I mean, so much of the opposition is now in exile or in jail, or they've been killed.
We have two types, or rather three types of opposition in Russia, opposition to regime. One is the communists, who at present have almost merged with Putin. The second are national patriotic forces. These are those people for the moving force of the war in Ukraine at the moment, the moving factor. And the third one is Democrats. I wouldn't call them liberals, but these are Democrats, democratic forces. And this part of the opposition at the moment is experiencing a lot of change. Those Democrats who stood for legal methods of fighting the regime, participating in elections, peaceful protests, that part of the opposition is slowly losing their influence on society. Those people in opposition who are gaining influence are those who think that to confront this regime can only be done by force, or at least by threat of force, threat of violence. And I think this process will come to fruition within the forthcoming few months.
Will it really happen that quickly, given the strength Putin's security forces have over the country?
People will mobilize, they are mobilizing, and there are already draft offices, conscription offices burning, being set on fire in dozens. Mobilization has been declared. People are going to find themselves on the battlefield, and they will be coming back, both injured or deserters, with weapons in their arms. These are the processes which will take a few months, perhaps until summer next year, and this will grow and become much more obvious, much more significant. And politically, this is quite fast.
I'm speaking with Russian exile and Putin opponent Mikhail Khodorkovsky. Mr. Khodorkovsky, in the 2000s, you led the important oil firm Yukos, and you famously challenged Vladimir Putin face-to-face on live TV in Russia. That video has basically disappeared from the internet. Take us back to that point in time. What were you trying to accomplish?
Has it really disappeared from the internet? Quite recently, I looked at the link and it was still on the YouTube. That was the point in time when Russian businesses wanted to move on, to become transparent. Our company, Yukos, was one of the leading Russian companies at the time. And we wanted to have an IPO in America. At the time, the Sarbanes-Oxley law was adopted in the US that demanded that companies control corruption practices within their own companies if they wanted to do an IPO in the stock market in the US. So my colleagues in the Russian Union of Industrialists and Entrepreneurs decided to go to Putin with a proposal and say to him, let's start global work, cleaning up, getting rid of corrupt practices in the country. Unfortunately, it turned out that Putin, in fact, had already decided the opposite. He had already decided that he was going to make corruption one of the linchpins of his regime. With the help of the corruption, he decided to control his closest circle. And fighting corruption was something totally unacceptable. And that was clearly obvious in that video. When we're talking about corruption, Putin, contrary to what any normal politician would do, who would in any case would say, oh yes, let's fight corruption, and then would do nothing. Putin didn't even find it in himself to say those words.
That event ended with a lengthy jail sentence for you. You were one of the most powerful men in Russia at the time, and you ended up in a gulag, a Siberian labor camp. You say prison changed you and your view of the world. Can you explain what you mean?
When I left to go to prison, I was a businessman. 10 years of prison, 10 years of jail, made entrepreneurship less interesting for me than it was for me before jail. I suddenly realized in myself that it is impossible to be free in business if the whole country is not free, if people in the country are not free. And fighting for democracy was first and foremost, was the main objective that had to be resolved, that had to be achieved, even compared with economic issues.
Can you imagine going home again, Mikhail Khodorkovsky? And where do you consider home?
Home, for me, as well as for many other people, is the place where my family, my friends are. At the moment, this circle has been dispersed across a whole range of countries. But if we're talking about my native land, my motherland, my fatherland, it's Russia. It's the only one. And I would like to be able, in my lifetime, to see that Russia has come back onto the path of democratic development. And if I can do anything to promote it, I will do it. If and when Putin leaves the political stage or just dies, this possibility will arise with a quite likelihood inside the country. And then for Russia, it would be dangerous to have this idea of searching for a good or kind czar. There could never be a kind czar in Russia. Such kind czars like Gorbachev lose power. What is important for Russia is to change the structure of power. Russia should become a parliamentary republic. Russia should become much more federalized in its makeup. But it should remain as Russia. And in that case, the world would have a non-aggressive neighbor, and Russia would get the possibility of democratic development. And whatever I can do in order to put it in place, I will do.
Mikhail Khodorkovsky joined us from London. His new book, written with Martin Sixsmith, is The Russia Conundrum. We spoke with Khodorkovsky through interpreter Elena Cook. Thank you very much.
Спасибо за этот разговор. До свидания.
You can hear our entire interview with Mikhail Khodorkovsky on our website, theworld.org. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you again tomorrow. From PRX.